Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, podcast listeners, this is Omar M. Khatib, your host for Journey to Private Practice, and we're joined by a very special guest. That's Dr. Cheng Ron, who is the founder, CEO, and clinician over at Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine. And I'm very proud to say he's also a Gentem customer, somebody that before was a Gentem customer. I said, I really hope he can, you know, he joins on board, but he's a man who has a true vision for what medicine can look like at scale with a very entrepreneurial mindset, which I love because in my opinion, my humble opinion, the best quality medicine for patient care and for healthcare are ones that are run by physicians. So Dr. Ron, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing very well. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, today's topic is very interesting, which is what does medicine look like at scale? And you have a very quotable quote, which is, you know, medicine healthcare was not designed to scale, it was designed to fail, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But before we do that, just, you know, at a very like high level, what is your origin story for some of our listeners who are just getting introduced to you? And I'm surprised that some people may be hearing about you for the first time because you have a huge Facebook following, I think like 500,000 or 600,000 people. You have a very big presence online, but what is your origin story? How'd you get into medicine? Where are you from?
Yeah, so I'm from China. I immigrated to the US in 1990 when I was 7 years old. So, you know, my mom does acupuncture and herbs, and my father worked for Baylor College of Medicine here in Houston at the time as an MD PhD researcher. So I kind of grew up in that integrative health mindset. And we literally took herbs my mom had and looked at what it does under the microscope of stem cells and cardiomyocytes and all this stuff like that, and actually got some papers published in the Texas Wow. Medical Center. So I kind of grew up curious about stuff like that, right? So integrative health has always been the normal for me. And if I got sick, you know, I'd get my mom to do acupuncture and give me some herbs and stuff like that. So that's really the origin of how I grew up. Now, growing up in Houston and in the biggest medical center in the world and having access to some really famous people who I didn't know were famous at the time, I was able to have a perspective very earlier on of what residency looked like and fellowship looked like, even when I was, you know, seven, 8 years old, running around Baylor College of Medicine. In seeing the interaction between the attendings and the fellows and the residents and the medical students, and it was very cool for me to have that experience. You know, what really sparked my interest was adopting that sort of integrative mindset within a Western medicine field, and part of the reason is because my grandpa established a Western medicine mindset into Eastern medicine field. So he brought in like aspirin and steroids and stuff like that to the Chinese rural population. So he was integrating health on the other side and on the other side of the world. And so, and I'm the sixth generation of physicians in the family. So it just kind of turned out that way. And it was something I was, you know, passionate about.
That's amazing. And you know, you may have been too young to realize it at the time, but I mean, when you were running around at Baylor College of Medicine in the 90s, you were there during like some of the glory years, because I think at the time still the DeBakey Cooley war on cardiac surgery was still waging on.
Yeah, so that was probably the heat of it. And being in the OR with
were you in the OR with DeBakey? Oh my god,
hilarious!
That
hilarious, yeah.
That could be a podcast literally just in itself.
yeah, for another time. I have a lot of stories growing up and. Dr. Cooley was fabulous. He actually put me under his wings and what eventually was built out to be the Texas Heart Institute, THI. And I got to be part of the grand opening for that and did research into that. So I had pretty cool and was really, really lucky to be exposed to all that earlier on.
That's amazing. And for some of those listeners that don't have a cardiac background, I mean, DeBakey and Cooley, this is like Michael Jordan and I don't know, LeBron or Kobe. They're essentially two Michael Jordans in my eyes. you know,
yeah,
literally
they're
within
like
a mile
Chamberlain
away.
Or something, you yeah. know, like old school, yeah,
and literally within less a mile of each other with the most fierce rivalry in medicine. I mean, I kind of miss that style of like medicine, like that kind of pioneering, because that was amazing. That when I was a kid, that kind of influenced me in my path to go to medical school, just because I was like, man, that's awesome. You know?
Yeah, well, me too. That really solidified my decision to proceed on to medical training and stuff like that. So it was fabulous. Yeah,
I can guarantee you that the cardiac surgeons and the cardiologists who listen to the show are going to message me and be like, "Can you please invite him back on for an episode just about the DeBakey years?" And so you just signed yourself up for that.
I'll do it.
So let's talk about your practice, because it's not your usual run of the mill. Private
no.
medical practice. There's something very special going on there. Just not just with the name, but if you even go to your website, right, it says a lot. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the practice name is Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine, and this is a prototype practice as an experiment to see if medicine could be scalable without doing the traditional practice of medicine. So what does that mean? So I think that. Medicine in the U.S., especially in primary care, has several flaws. And probably the biggest one is also the reason why a lot of practices don't make it is communication between the physicians, leaders, and the staffs, between the staffs and the patients, between the physicians and the patient, between the patient and the insurance companies, right, between us and the insurance companies. There's so many rifts, and I call it the four rifts of medicine, are those conflicts. And before starting the practice, I was very fortunate to be a partner in another practice where I got to see the intricacies and the business behind it for a few years. And so Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine was founded upon the principle that we can incorporate communication, lifestyle, and something really sexy at the time called SDOHs, basically the social determinants of health. Which is something that the CDC was really wanting to get into the American public, overseen by the WHO. So talking about social determinants of health, talking about who do they have access to? What do they have access to? Are they living alone? Are they living, you know, are they homeless and stuff like that? So those are really hardly addressed in the primary care setting. And even if they are, there's not much physicians can do about it. So from the practice of lifestyle medicine, we take all that into consideration and we start to build our relationship with patients, not necessarily as we're their heroes, but we're their coaches or we're their guides, if you will. And where medicine has gone wrong in the U.S. is that physicians are seen as heroes. And I actually don't think that should be the case. Mm. Physicians should really be seen as guides. And honestly, because heroes suffer tragedies, we call that physician burnout, right? But guides are seen in a very different light. It's like, you know, you watch Star Wars. Luke Skywalker is a hero. He suffered many tragedies, right? But look at Yoda. Yoda's kind of chilling in the corner right there, advising on certain things. And I think that we should really be guides for our patients, because it actually speaks to a much higher level of communication and trust rather than the hero. And so, you know, if you look at our website, you know, Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine.org or TX or TCLM. So if you look at what our website looks like, the first thing that you'll see is the word collaboration, right? It's like we really promote a collaborative type of medicine, because it's not about how good the doctor is, it's about how good your physician team is. Mm-hmm. And what communication is theirs. I can't tell you how many times my team reached out and gathered all the specialists here to have a conglomeration of ideas and then present that to the patients of how much that it impacted patient lives. And what people don't understand is that these things are actually reimbursable. There's actually procedure codes, CPT codes for communication that came out. First in 2019, now it's even more robust in 2021. There's communication codes. If you're sending patients emails and vice versa, or text messages, or short phone calls, 5 to 10 minute short phone calls. These are all sort of billable events, and they've been there for a while in medicine, But because the practice of medicine is so backwards thinking in that one-to-one doctor-patient relationship within an office, it kind of imploded into our fixed costs are getting higher. We have to do way more crap with the EMR and documentation and administrative stuff. So that continued to increase our fixed costs, increasing burnout. But that one-on-one reimbursement structure hasn't really changed. And so what we really wanted to do is to capitalize on not just the one-on-one, but one-to-many. So we started doing group sessions, which people love the group session. We got so much good data out of it and great outcomes out of it. And we started talking to people in virtual groups and stuff like that. So I think we kind of took medicine into the classroom setting and adopted a business plan out of it. And you know, I'm not going to tell you it was easy. It was not. Failed many times, but we started speaking with insurance companies and then speaking to CMS at the federal level. And all of a sudden, there's this giant movement after 2020 and the pandemic to do this type of medicine. And that's where medicine is headed to in the very near future.
And you said something very important that I want to go back and highlight, which is this idea of doing it as a group. Because if you take your usual, let's just say the stereotypical patient who's dealing with diabetes, it's the same talk track, same kind of questions every single time. You know, what can I eat? What can't I eat? How do I do this? How do I make sure that, you know, I'm not at risk? And so it makes no sense to have to do, if medicine has to get more streamlined, why do that every single time with each patient and not in a group setting, right? And that's essentially what you're saying, which is looking for the inefficiencies in medicine and say, well, in any other industry, they would have done this as a group. Why not in medicine? Is that correct?
Yes, but there's something way higher level than that. Is that when you're a teacher in a group, you're officially a guide. You're not the hero anymore. You're a guide, right? And you're actually providing value, and it's not taught to as a medical school. But more importantly, within a group, and this is what we see every time, each of the group dynamics of the people within the group are so solid that bonds can be formed within a group setting, not between the physician or the nurse practitioner and the patient or the dietitian with the patient, but within the group itself. And we see this in psychiatry. We see this in dietetics, right? We see this
AA is a good example of that.
Neuro.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this has already been done. If you look at the definition of a DIGMA, D-I-G-M-A, drop-in group medical visit, that was defined back in the early 90s by the American Academy of Family Practice, right? And so at that, if you actually Google it and type in DIGMA, it was defined in, I think, in 1993. And it says, oh, the future of medicine within the next 10 years, most people will be seen in groups. Well, it still hasn't happened, but I think we're transitioning to that finally after about 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a very powerful, powerful tool.
Ben, that's fantastic. And you know, it makes so much sense too, because, you know, a lot of times when you're, like, perfect example is someone in my family who's a physician at age 45 or 48, they were diagnosed with diabetes, and that was extremely upsetting and scary for them. And so for patients to be within a group where they're not only being taught and being guidance by the physician, but they have peers to work through this together, it's a lot less scary. And I'm sure that the outcomes, the compliance, everything is just better because the patient isn't just by themselves dealing with this anymore.
Yeah, and we get to celebrate together too, you know?
Tell me about that.
Oh man, so many stories. But the first one that really came to mind is you know, I have one of our fabulous health coaches. Her name is Jenny, and she's our mind-body medicine coach. And I remember going into a group session, and we were doing, I presented this data on how breathing exercises can drop your blood sugar by up to 20 points, right? I'm like, you know what? Let's try to prove it. Let's try to prove this. So it's called box breathing. So you inhale for, you know, inhale for 2 seconds, exhale for 2 seconds, and it's like a box. And then we did it for a longer period. So we did it, and so it was published in a very fabulous national journal. And then so this one guy who has type 1 diabetes, and with a continuous glucose monitor, you can actually see the actual drop here. And then it's hilarious because I was like, this is crazy. And then like all six people started like applauding and stuff like that. I'm like, we just found a way to lower your blood sugar for free
by breathing.
It doesn't involve eating kale chips, right? So it's fun when you practice medicine like this because you get to celebrate together, you get to discover things together, and I'm always inquisitive, and we always look at this data of how to help our patients, and it's sort of this light bulb moment. And then we have other, you know, we have cooking sessions and stuff like that, and I introduce people to the idea of a purple yam, which is a resistant starch, which does not elevate blood sugar very much, but it's very sweet, and you put it in the freezer, kind of tastes like ice cream. So we did a thing where I gave people this and told them it was ice cream. And they really believed me. I was like, no, that's a purple yam. So, you know, it's stuff like that, that you get to kind of have fun with. But that those are just, you know, two really cool stories that we have, that we've seen in a lot of patients, which, you know, garnered a lot of success. And I do think that's why we're so passionate about just the process of communicating with the patients, but also knowing that this is a viable business and the prototype that we've built is not only viable, but it can be scalable as well.
I love that. And what I love about this, I mean, I have a bias about physicians staying independent and staying in private practice, but the other thing, yeah, seriously, but the other thing, you know, I grew up in West Texas in El Paso. My father was a surgeon, had his own practice, right? And so the kind of medicine I grew up seeing was that a physician, and this is why I looked up to my father and I wanted to be a physician at one point before I went into tech, was that it's not enough just to be a physician. You have to be a leader in the community. So you read these novels where the physician was somebody who was guiding like local politics and you know, helping, you know, being a key part of the community. And what I love about this is it's beyond just practicing medicine. Right, it's giving people guidance in their entire life, because there's so many things like what we read in Robbins' pathology or Harrison's, like patients don't fit in a drop down menu or a box. There's so many things that complicate things, right? Including stress. How often do you think a physician knows how to educate their patient on like, hey, here are a couple breathing exercises or ways you can just easily meditate that'll lower your stress. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And we actually, for people coming in and they have high blood pressure, like we're not going to take their blood pressure when they first come in. I was like, here's the 60-second meditation exercise. I want to do it. And then we'll take your blood pressure again, because I don't believe that this is your real blood pressure.
See,
you know,
that's, yeah. See, I love that, because that's true medicine, which is this inquisition, questioning things and saying, you know, is this really their real blood pressure, or is it just because they literally walked in? This is the first time they're meeting me. They're feeling vulnerable. You know, so a patient who's overweight, they're getting ready to step on the scale, and people are going to see their weight, right? So these things, like, it's common sense when you think about it, but nobody's stopping to actually question the process. And it seems like your practice is leading the way in saying, "Hey, these things, they're very easy to implement. They're not expensive, and they make things better. And you can scale a business." Everybody wins. So my question is, why aren't more clinics doing this?
Oh man, simple answers.
It's because your mastermind's going to roll out maybe in a few months. That's what we're already not yet.
Yeah, exactly. It's my mastermind's coming out in 2022. But one of the reasons is, man, that's not how medicine's taught. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, you go by national blood pressure guidelines and have the patient sit there and take your blood pressure in this way or that. But I, come on. I mean, we're the practice of medicine is driven by very specific things we do with outcomes that may or may not fit within a box called a guideline, right? You have guidelines for American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, you know, USPSTF, and all these different things. And a lot of times they clash with each other. Like right now, like, is the real time to get a colonoscopy? Is it 45 or is it 50? Well, depending on which guideline you read, right?
Exactly.
And I think that physicians are taught, especially in residency, that you want to practice within that guidelines, otherwise you may get sued, right? And you're always operating out of
CYA medicine, right?
The CYA medicine. And I train in New York, which means that we didn't have the great protection we have in Texas here for lawsuits. But mm-hmm. You know, training in New York, it's like everything is a CYA type of medicine. So So like it's ingrained within you. Like don't think outside the box. But what happens is like, you just start getting more and more burnt out. And I was reading the implementation of AI and how it replaces physicians. Well, it's only replacing physicians because the AI knows the updated guidelines, right?
Yeah.
But as a physician, it's an artistry. Like we have to communicate with our patients. There's a human element to it that the AI can't do. So who cares whether there's AI or not? Maybe I can guide the AI to help me understand things better from a knowledge side. But me as a physician, I still have that human element. And the human element's not taught very well in medical training.
Absolutely. You know? It's not taught well. And more importantly, you cannot replace it. You know, AI and technology is really there to alleviate things that a human being should not be wasting time doing, so we can focus on things that we are good at, which is, you know, the human touch, right? And I think that on the good side, it's good that medicine over the last few, 50 years has evolved to be very rigorous on the science side, on the technology, on the business side. But these things have overwhelmed and literally pushed out the art of it completely out. Like there, for the viewers, they can't see it. I'm in my library. There are books that my father gave me that are 40, 50 years old on the practice of medicine, talking about how you're supposed to touch a patient, right? How do you engage with them? How do you look at them, right? The tone of voice. These things have an effect. They're not taught anymore.
You know, you're right. When I was chief resident at New York Presbyterian in Queens, I held a workshop for some residents. And actually, we had a mix of internal medicine residents and ER residents come in. And we actually had some fun because it included some wine. But one of it is like, how do you approach a patient? And my workshop was actually on the language of being compassionate. And you know, I'll give you a really cool example. So there's a patient that came in and he's like, oh, my chest hurts and I'm short of breath. I'm terrified and I don't know what to do. And so the ER doc's like, well, don't worry about it. I got you. Let's get an EKG. You know, if it's something serious, we'll take care of it now. Well, there's a problem with that. in that you establish yourself to be the hero first before exploring a little more, right? And so one of the things that I encourage people to do for that week is if a patient comes in like that, you know, instead of saying, hey, this is what we can do, ask them, what do you think is going on? What is the worst case scenario and the best case scenario of what you think is actually going on? The minute you ask that, you now empower them to think so they have a perceived control over their medical journey, right? Which they may or may not have real control, but what happens is that you just flip yourself into the guidance mentality. And guess what? The review scores of those residents were astronomically higher for that week with a challenging question. It's like, what do you really think is going on? And then after they ask, what do you think is going on? I was like, how do you think that I can help you to the worst case scenario at this time? And then now what happens is they give the resident the permission to be the hero, but it's on their terms. Does that make sense?
100%.
And so, 100%. Yeah. And so that's
permission-based medicine. Permission-based
medicine. Yeah. And when we got the scores back, I was sitting there with the chief of medicine and he was just kind of blown away. I'm like, man, we should do this like all the time, which didn't end up happening because I left shortly after as the chief resident to come back to Texas. And that like stimulated me to think, okay, wow, how am I going to approach patients? So a lot of times patients come in and I stop assuming why they're in the office. It doesn't matter what my medical system's putting on there, you know, refills for blood pressure, whatever, right? And so I'm sitting down. I was like, you know what? I see my medical system wrote that you're refill blood pressure, but just out of curiosity, what are your health goals for 2021? And that always takes people back. It's like, oh man, I haven't thought about that, you know? it opens up such a beautiful conversation. And then all of a sudden, they're letting things out. They had never told anyone because no one really asked them what they really wanted. And that, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes in the doctor's office, maybe the only time that year this patient is being asked what they really want, because a lot of times they live in this state of demand. They're caregivers for their family. You know, they work all the time or in school all the time and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And by doing that, you establish this beautiful connection within just one or two phrases. And I think just by adopting that behavior, it changes the doctor from that hero to more of a guide. And immediately, a lot of the burnout the doctor's experience can reduce, because now the perceived value of a physician is much higher. In the marketing world, I used to own a digital marketing company. In the marketing world, we're all about perceived value, you know? We did this thing where we sent out questionnaires to ask patients, how long did you think your doctor spent time with you? So for the residents who spoke in the way that we directed it, the time they spent with the patient, the perceived time, is twice as long as the people who didn't go through this method.
And it's the same amount of time.
It's the same amount of time, right? So the perceived time is very, it's like double. And that's what's crazy about it. They may not remember what you told them, but they'll always remember how you make them feel.
Hey, podcast listeners, I want to share a story with you. Now, believe it or not, my father was a private practice owner just like you. He had his own general surgery practice for 35 years and spent the last 10 doing varicose veins and other vascular procedures in his office. He loved private practice because he was in control of how he practiced medicine. But even back then, billing was an issue. Now, despite that, my father was lucky to choose when he wanted to retire, and he did so with his independence as a clinician and a practice owner. But not everyone is lucky like that these days. That's because getting reimbursed is even more complicated than ever. Practicing medicine today comes with more headaches and more responsibilities. So along with the complexities and demand of caring for your patients, your mind is also occupied with all these headaches that come with running a private practice, like submitting claims and managing your accounts receivables, dealing with insurance companies and denials. All of that just to get reimbursed in time and in full. And more often than not, that doesn't happen that way. And this can be such a tough task and extremely frustrating, but it does not have to be like that anymore. To adapt in a world with an ever-changing environment, especially in healthcare, means to seize opportunities when you see them. And that opportunity is to use data-driven technologies. That's why you need a trusted partner like Gentem. Gentem is a Silicon Valley-based company founded by a Stanford-educated physician and a former Facebook software engineer. And they found that uncovering hidden revenue in your claims is the key to increasing your cash flow and staying independent. It's only possible through what's called predictive reimbursement modeling, and that's on Gentem's platform. Why is that important? Because then you're using the power of data to see how well your practice is doing, how to maximize reimbursements, decrease the time it takes for you to get it reimbursed. And more importantly, as payers get more creative with denials, you're able to use the data to adapt and stay ahead. And not only that, but you also get the support of Gentem's remarkable team of medical practice experts with decades of experience in healthcare. They're an extension of your practice in that they work with all departments to achieve optimal revenue with dedicated resources, including certified billers, coders, and revenue cycle managers, all working and paying attention to the data specific to your region and your specialty. Gentem also develops products specifically made for private medical practices. So when your practice is ready to invest in hiring more staff, perhaps new technology, or even acquiring a facility or building one out yourself, don't go and fill out a long, complicated application at the bank and get handcuffed to a high-interest bank loan. Gentem uses Gentem Advance to essentially advance payments to you based on your outstanding AR. You get the capital that you need today to grow, and then you pay it back based on your future claims.
So head over to gentem.com/podcast demo and get your free billing and reimbursement assessment along with a demo of our platform and service to see what's right for you. And now let's get back to the show. Absolutely. And what's amazing is how so much of this is connected, not to get like super meta on you, but there's, not just within marketing, but even with itself within like, tragedy and self-development, I tell people that you have the power within your own mind to decide how you're going to perceive this and author your own life. And there's a quote that I love that I don't know where it came from. Maybe I came up with it. I'll take credit for it. But the quote is that, all is mind, the universe is mental. And I think, what you just pointed out makes so much sense, because within a certain, you know, everything's so much perception based. And a lot of times I think because as a physician, the physician might go through how they're trained, because like, I need to get this information out, but they don't realize, like, a simple question like, why are you here to see us, right? Simple question. But if it's asked the wrong way, in the wrong tone, to a patient who's upset, maybe they had a big fight with their spouse, maybe they're worried about all these things, they come in and now they're like, who's this asshole and why are they talking to me like this? And then they leave and they eat a bad, and it becomes a cycle. When in fact, it just takes a second to stop and ask, like, you know, maybe I should just put it on them and get a little extra information, and that'll help me in the long run, versus coming in with my own assumptions and telling them what to do. Is that the right way to think about it, Dr. Wong?
It is, but we're not trained to do that, right? And the other thing to think about that piggybacks on with this is that the most powerful phrase that you can tell a patient is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. And doctors are terrified. And I use that all the time. If I truly don't know something, I was like, hey, listen, I want to help you, but I don't know. And I just pause. And then they're like, oh thank you. You know, I was not taught to say I don't know. First of all, you know, I'm Asian and we're immigrant family. So there's nothing that we don't know. You know, I'm Chinese, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, you know everything. through residency, I learned better, but I teach my nurse practitioners and my physician partner this, is that the word I don't know is just so powerful because it's humility, right? And so another good example, so we see a lot of fourth or fifth consults, which means that by the time they see four or five physicians, I mean, we're their sixth opinion, if you will, right? And a lot of these people have gone all over the country or the world or whatever, right? But they ended up sticking with us, not because we know more, because we don't know more. And they know that we don't know, but guess what? We'll always have their back. That's the point of collaborative medicine, right? And so I have a lot of patients that come in, and within a new patient visit, they're like, oh, this doctor did this, and this doctor did this, and this doctor just wants to put me on medications. And every time I'm like, you know what? I want to thank this doctor for being part of your journey, because this doctor has tools that allow them to care for you, but they only know what they know, but they don't know what they don't know. And I'm the same way. So let's forgive everything and let them know that whatever path you've been on, you landed in my office, and I'm going to see what we can do to help guide you in your journey, right? And so, and that's a language that I like to use with the patients. But like I said, are we smarter than other doctors? No, we're not. But what we are is showing that we're able to have compassion and collaboration. And we also know that the value of coming to our office is not a prescription. It's conversation and it's collaboration. And most people think that takes more time. It actually doesn't. It's the way that the perceived time is more. But, you know, so I started using an AI scribing service. And by the time I'm finished and I hit whatever, I'm like, oh, thanks. You know, the last 11 minutes has been really powerful. They're like, oh, it's only been 11 minutes. I was like, you cover more than that, I thought, you know, you can cover it in an hour. I'm like, yeah, well, that's what we do, right? And so, by the way, I'm a data miner. I keep track of everything. Every minute, every second that I speak, I keep track of to see how much I can accomplish, to see if things are better, right? And so so the perceived value, the perceived time, saying I don't know is just exceptionally important. And letting the patients know that, okay, I don't know, but I still want to help. You know, but and I see a lot of doctors do the following. They're like, okay, well, patient, you know, I don't know what to prescribe you, so there's not really a reason for you to come back anymore. And the patient takes offense to that because the patient perceives the doctor doesn't want to help them anymore, which is false. The doctor does want to help them, but the only tool the doctor has is like Crestor or, you know, or something like that, right? And so, instead, the doctor could be like, okay, well, you know, there's nothing prescriptive I can offer you. But if you want to go on the journey of, you know, lifestyle and wellness, I think that's a totally cool plan. Let's just follow up in 90 days and you go on that journey and I can check your labs again. No one says that. You know, and I feel like it's really crazy that no one says that, because once again, the perceived value is in the power of prescription, which I mean, we're in 2020 and it's definitely not the case. You know, cancel culture is all out there. People are very critical about professionals these days. And so we really have to adapt to changes.
No, 100%, 100%. And, you know, I want to, you know, talk about some other areas of scale on medicine, but one thing that kind of stood out to me in your story and everything you just shared, which is what we often see, and again, I'm a guy in tech, I built my career in medical technology, robotics, etc. But these things are invented to supplement and augment and amplify things. Oh, yeah. When in reality, medicine, unfortunately, and physicians, you know, and who, you know, I don't know, there's not like a bad person in this. Use these things to replace the art, versus what you have done is you've taken the technology to do the art at scale. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, man. You know, I'm in several Facebook groups, very large Facebook groups with physicians, private practice physicians, and there's just so much resentment in technology because, oh my God, I have to keep up with it or whatever. And there's a lot of resentment in other professionals too. It's like, oh, you know, we're being replaced by nurse practitioners and PAs and stuff like that. And I just think it's not necessary if you understand the business side to things and if you can create solid security structures for yourself. So the point of technology is consistency, right? And so if you're thinking, okay, well, what are my five areas in my practice that's inconsistent? Okay. And by the way, for most practices, and I've done surveys on this, is billing, all right, front desk, back office, medical assistance, right? And then management is the top five, right? And billing's always number one. There's no consistency to it. I'm like, well, if that's the case, then you need to adopt technology to cover each one of this to develop the consistency. Because guess what? A robot's going to work 24/7 for you, right? And if you think that, you know, you don't have enough money to build a process and stuff like that, well, the alternative is worse, which is extinction.
Yeah.
So I think that by looking at technology as consistency and working with companies and vendors that are consistent, that speak your same language, that can guide you become a better physician or a practice or whoever you are, that's the people that you want to work with, right? And that's the technology you want to adopt on. And another, so take billing, for example, right? So in no medical practice I talk to, is there any predictable in reimbursement of this insurance plan with this CPT code over a period of time? It's just like, okay, let's look at historical data, right? Well, a human has to go and look at historical data and maybe put it into the spreadsheet, which takes a bazillion hours, right? There's technology that overcomes that, right? That's what Gentum is, right?
Exactly.
And then let's look at Scribe, like on my phone, like scribing. Like, why can't a robot listen to my conversation with a patient and then put it for me into my EMR? You know, we have that now. So that it helps me have eye contact with the patient when talking to them, which is exceptionally important. And then you look at staff. Okay, most medical practices have a tremendous amount of staff turnover. And most of the time it happens when the doctor is actually away on vacation because to avoid confrontation. And I was like, well, why don't you have SOPs and systems put together on some sort of a digital platform so that every person can be trained the same way? You know, that's literally why I worked at McDonald's when I was in high school. So I want to know how they're training. And I went through McDonald's University and it was so sequential. You know, if you look at Starbucks, it's the same thing. Like every step is accounted for. It's crazy. And so put that into a system. So we have an online training program through another company called Trainual that has all our training programs. We have videos for everything like that. And if someone screws up, it's not because we first think it's not because you're incompetent. Maybe we didn't include it in the training program. And then if I see that you did it in the training program and you passed this section in our little test right here, then we can say, okay, maybe there's some competency skills that we have to do, right? And then so that's quality control of your employees, because they are your right hand, right? And then there's, you know, front office, back office, all of these things can be streamlined with technology. Why technology? Because the cost of healthcare can be significantly cheaper if you have the right technology. And when I say cheaper, I don't necessarily mean just cheaper for your current practice. I'm saying cheaper as you scale your practice, because a lot of these are completely necessary to scale, because, you know, private practice is designed not to scale. That's how medicine works.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think that, you know, a lot of this, again, like going back to the other theme, which is the idea of reframing and perception, right? I think that the culture of medicine is very much based on, you know, even though the art is not as practiced as much these days, the culture of it is rooted in art. And so the idea that you go and put in your 10,000 hours through medical school training, et cetera, you get out and you find out that there's a robot or a technology that does part of what you do, it can be upsetting. But the technology is it's not good or bad. It's an inanimate object. What you make of it is what's important. And so either you could fight it and say, I don't get it, I don't like it, et cetera, or you look at it and say, you know, I have no choice. This thing is here in my environment. So how do I incorporate this and adapt it? And if I'm not doing this, so this part of my time is not being used for it, how do I scale something else that technology can't help me with, right? And I mean, this is by no means, should anyone ever compare marketing to medicine? But just as an example, I remember many years ago when the algorithms on Facebook and different things got better, a lot of marketers, performance marketers, got pissed because they were really good at doing that manually, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I didn't fight that. And I said, okay, that's great. This is not going away. So while that's happening and other marketers spend time trying to fight against and say, no, I'm better than the algorithm. You're not going to be better than the algorithm. You're an idiot. This is in the early days when Facebook released their ad platform. I said, okay, well, now that I'm freed up there, I can't beat the AI there. What am I better at? I'm going to be better at copywriting. I'm going to be better at design. I'm going to be better at other things. And lo and behold, that's how I was able to move up in my career, right? And then these things, they're all very cyclical. Now, Facebook had a change on their algorithm. And so you can't just throw things on the algorithm anymore. So now the marketers who spent all this time just like throwing things on that algorithm, they didn't spend the time scaling on the creativity side, the design, the stuff that actually makes sense. And now they're having to start over. For me, it's just like, well, it's another change like anything else. You just change with the times and scale.
Yeah, I'm going to use exactly what you use, but I'm going to direct it at medicine now. All right.
You read my mind. Thank you. That's why you're a great host.
So check this out. And I actually do think that medicine should be compared to marketing, because I'm going to do it right now. So you talk about Facebook, which is a gigantic entity. All right. So instead of Facebook, let's call that CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Okay? I already love where this is going.
All right. So the problem is with digital marketers, they're looking at algorithms because they have metrics. Doctors don't have metrics, man. You know, even the large institutions don't have these metrics when they look at what CMS is putting out, what United Healthcare, Blue Cross Blue Shield, because it seems too complex, right? But your livelihood depends on it, but then you're busy being a doctor and serving the patients and being that hero, right? You got to be a hero to yourself first, yourself and your staff. I mean, they come first. Yourself, your family, your staff, they all come first before the actual patients do, because that's what drives the system and that's what decreases medical liability. It also decreases medical errors, you know? And so if the algorithm of CMS has completely changed starting in 2019, 2020 blew up, 2021, complete massive overhaul. How many of my physician friends know the new E&M and CPT guidelines? Very, very little, unless I'm the one who told them about it first. I actually knew November, so 2 months before it came out. November 15th is when AMA had their meeting, which I attended to figure out why these guidelines were put out in the first place. Lo and behold, they put it out back in 2016, but it didn't take action until coronavirus made them take action on it, right? So now look at 2021. The 2021 AMA CPT panel came out with all these different rules and new codes and took away old codes and stuff like that, from audiology to physician visits to neurology and all the stuff like that. And so the algorithms has completely changed, man. It's got it's completely changed. And unless you have a system to monitor that change, you don't know what's going on. If you don't look at your revenue cycle, or if you don't know what a revenue cycle is, that's a big problem. If you're in private practice, you got to know what a revenue cycle is. If you look at your revenue cycle and you're like, I don't know how I made this penny, like, you're going to be screwed when the algorithm changes even more, because you're going to be so behind. You know, that's why, you know, Gentium is so, it's such a valuable thing. But if you take that to every aspect of what you do, look at, you know, SEO, search engine optimization within your clinic website, or if you look at these algorithms, those are really important to see, because these are algorithms that dictate your livelihood and your longevity. Now, CMS, because we have so many Medicare and private insurance patients, that we have to look at that to understand how to scale and how to adapt to risk and de-risk things that are too high of a risk for us to do, and sort of narrow our focus on different things and be absolutely like essential to the process, right? And so your digital marketers, they know the algorithm of YouTube. I mean, YouTube had a huge change in November of 2020. Look at, you know, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, whichever it is. But man, no, like, why aren't physicians really looking at the CMS changes? Because it's complex and they don't have the tools to know what the revenue cycles are. And so everyone's kind of falling behind, right? So you got to adopt to technology to do this.
I'm sold. You know what? I changed my mind. You're absolutely right. The analogies aren't good at persuasion, but they are damn good at explaining things. You are absolutely correct. That makes complete sense. And at least from the marketing standpoint, we have to keep up with these algorithm changes, because what was working organically or even paid even a few weeks ago or a month ago may not be working now. And if you don't know about those changes, you don't monitor it, you end up spending a lot of time, which you don't get back, or a lot of money, which you know, at least budget-wise, you definitely don't get back. And this is the thing that is shocking to me. And this is kind of what brought me to Gentium, which is, in every other business, you open your shop, hey, you do a service, you get paid. Look, when, you know, I talked to a physician earlier today on a private call, and he said, the thing that pisses me off the most as a surgeon is that I'll go do a procedure, okay? And depending on the type, the patient, the insurance type, I'm going to get paid differently for the exact same thing, and I'm going to get paid, you know, at some point in the future. The rep who comes and brings the hardware for that case is going to get paid at the end of the week the same amount regardless. Why is that? And so because of those things, physicians more than anybody need data-driven strategies and technology. And if you don't have that, you're going to get farther and farther and farther behind. It's no wonder why some of these physicians and practices of Gentium helps. They have, like, you know, a million or 2 million in AR, or they have, you know, 300,000, like, for example, 300,000 in hidden revenue that's purely preventable. And it's like, oh, we had no idea, you know, because it's in a spreadsheet somewhere, because you're relying on a human being to do it.
Yeah. 300,000 is a small number for most practices that we actually look at, you know, that I coach, that, you know, the no one's, you know, here's the thing. And I was talking to my good friend who's actually starting a pediatric practice in Houston. And you know, I think the startup doctor is always like, yeah, I'm going to start doing billing myself and get a website out there. I'm going to, you know, use a Wix account or whatever it is, right? And so, which is fine, because that's literally how I started in the very beginning. But the problem is that you got to learn from the mistakes of other people who've been in your shoes, right? And my mistake was that I did not know my numbers. I knew it down to the thousands of dollars. I didn't know it down to the penny. I want to know down to the penny now. If there's anything my CFO has taught me is that you got to know things down to the penny. Where do they come from? When are you going to get your money? And there's got to be a percentage predictability that's on it. And that's how you drive business. But you're right. That rep that sells the device or the meds, whatever it is, it's the same. There's a predictability for it. But that's actually not a bad thing, is because if you have variability and variety in reimbursements And if you have the right data, then you know how to, what to do with the data. So if, you know, I was talking to an orthopedic surgeon, for example, and he's like, dude, you know, I get, you know, 2 times more for doing this shoulder from United Healthcare than I do from, you know, Anthem. And I'm like, well, do you have data on you know, metrics and improvements? He's like, yeah, I have data on, you know, patient metrics and outcomes and stuff like that. And then I was like, well, if you have that, and then if you have a revenue that's generated by other insurance companies, it's like, yeah, this is not fair. Why are you down here? And I did this with Cigna last year. Like, why are you down here and everyone else is down here? Look how much value you provide. Most doctors don't know. They can go to insurance companies, talk about the contracts and change it. And like, everyone can change it, actually. And so that part, people are afraid. I was like, oh my God, I need a lawyer and stuff like that. No, just had a conversation. I was like, listen, Cigna, like you insure the city of Houston Public Services Department, and we have X number of patients, and we have reduced their hemoglobin A1C of diabetics and pre-diabetics to this within a 3-month period. This is us compared to the benchmark. Like, why are you giving us like 40% less than Blue Cross Blue Shield right now? Or 17% less than Medicare fees. Like, it doesn't make sense to us, right? And so once you start the conversation and provide value, they will actually listen. Insurance companies literally will listen, but you gotta have the data, you gotta have the graphs, you gotta have all that stuff there and using it as ammunition. That's what drives, I mean, that one conversation with the insurance company can be multiple millions of dollars over the next 5 to 10 years for your practice. And it's that huge.
That's amazing. And, you know, again, you know, being so busy, I'm very grateful that you're spending some time with us, and I want to be respectful of your time, but just to kind of wrap up on a couple of topics. So, you know, and I'll leave links for the show notes. But first of all, you know, I wanted to ask you about, you know, some of the key pieces of advice you give to some of the practices that you're coaching. But before we get to that point, I know you have a very special summit coming up for private practice. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Physician Practice AI Upgrade Summit. It's kind of a long name, but it's designed for private practice docs who are maybe a little burnt out and want to have consistency in different parts of their practice. And I call it AI partially because we have companies that feature the AI products to improve healthcare. And a lot of them are actually physician-owned companies. So it's a nice peer-to-peer discussion, right? But more importantly, that really is a lead into discussing things that are truly more emotional on the private practice side. Is how do you stay within private practice? How do you avoid burnout? How do you have better personal relationships, not just with your patients, but with your spouse and with your family and stuff like that? And so I really want to have a very raw discussion with physicians, with companies about how to tackle the pain points. So that's what the Physician Practice AI Summit is about. It's coming out October 18th is the first day. It goes for 7 days at least, unless we get more interviewees. It seems like a lot of people want to be on the summit. But it's a virtual summit. And if you go to newpracticecoding.com, it actually is a sign up for the summit, but you also get a free gift. You get the 2021 CPT communication guidelines. It's actually a flowchart of how do you bill for emails, text messages, phone calls with the patients, whether you're a provider or a medical staff or a mid-level and whatnot. And so it's something that I put a lot of work into, but it's a nice one sheet that kind of tells you everything.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And we'll leave the link for that in the show notes. Now, something that I want to leave the audience with, and I know that we're going to definitely have you back, but, you know, with the practices, you know, that are able to get a hold of you, that you do coaching with, you know, for the private practice owner who's listening to this right now, you know, you mentioned knowing your numbers down to the penny, right? You mentioned leveraging technology, but if you had to say they were going to, let's say, listen to this podcast and tomorrow they're going to wake up, what are three things that you tell them, hey, this week, these three things, you make sure that you do these three things this week or know them. What are those three actions that can kind of get them started towards building that scalable practice?
First thing is ask the people around you What are the strengths and weaknesses of the business? And also ask your spouse or the family around you, like, what do they wish they see more out of you? Is it more time? Is it, you know, being more present and not being on the cell phone, taking call and stuff like that? And it's like a check-in for yourself of where you are. And when you know where you are, you define where you want to go and be uncompromising about it, right? And so I find that no one truly understands where they are until they ask for it for the people around them. And then another thing is you got to be open to conversations of the people who you perceive the most uncomfortable to talk to. Those are the people that you need to talk to. Because you want to be able to have knowledge from every angle. And part of my coaching is that I get everyone to fill out a DISC assessment, D-I-S-C, personality profile. And people who have different DISC assessments speak very differently. And a lot of times I can even predict the conflict between team members even before it happens. I write down a piece of paper, and then when it happens, I pull out my piece of paper. So here you go. I wrote it back 2 weeks ago. I knew this was going to happen. You know, so I wouldn't know that had I not understand the characteristics of people's personalities. But there's always ways around that. And then the last thing is you got to be truthful to yourself. You know, optimism kills. And I know that because it's killed me multiple times. Well, I survived, I guess. You know, just my DISC profile is a high I, which means it's very influential, which means optimism is always there, no matter what. But there's cautious optimism that you really have to take, and you can't just assume things are going to be good once you develop the procedure for it, or once you set it. There's no such thing as set it and forget it in life or in business ever, and you have to keep on top of exactly what's going on and be that leader, and be that leader for yourself as well. So uncompromising road of where you want to go.
That's fantastic. And even for somebody who's not a physician, you know, that. Those are very valuable things that I'm going to take to heart, and I can actually impart that on some of my team members even. So thank you for sharing that. Now, the last part of the show, you know, to kind of wrap up, we do a sort of a fun rapid fire question. So you can answer these as quickly as you want or take as long as you want. Okay. You ready?
Sure.
All right. So my first question to you, it's an easy one. Medicine's about continuing education, right? So there's no stopping in learning. What's a book that you felt that you've gifted or recommended more often than not to people, and why?
The book is Essentialism. basically, it's The Art of Doing Less. this one phrase may really describe your life if you're listening to it. It's the phrase that, you know, complexity is the enemy of progress. And I think that as physicians, we adopt things that are very complex and may not really need to. So I think essentialism is a fabulous place to start. And it's not just about business. It's about your life and labeling what's essential for it.
Absolutely. It's a great book, by the way. It helps put things into perspective, very binary. All right. So my next question to you, obviously you've had some fantastic mentors. I mean, you know, your mother and father, you're very grateful to have those kind of people in your life. But, you know, as you grew up and went to medical school and then residency, you know, and fellowship and whatnot, you had some mentors along the way that helped you. What was the most memorable but painful thing a mentor ever told you that changed who you are for the better?
You are not who you hire. You are who you don't fire. That is Tony Robbins. He's a great mentor of mine. And I'm a DISC profile, I'm a high I, which means that I fear loss of connection. That still hits me. And as I say it, I just get shivers down my spine. But that's the absolute truth. And then I'm going to put two on here, actually.
Yeah, no, please. Because that was a hell of an answer.
And the second one is you get what you tolerate. They go very well together, right? And I'm not going to expand on it because if you're listening to me, you know exactly what I mean.
I love you. So you made it into my quote book, and in my garage gym, I have a quote board. I put things up that I want to remind myself. Those two are going up on there. Those are fantastic.
There you go. Yep.
Well, all right. So my last question to you, I want you to imagine that for the next year, Gentem is a startup. We don't have this budget, just, you know, but for the next year, let's pretend that I come to you and say, hey, we took out an advertisement, and now we have every single billboard in every major city, every small town, everywhere. And every private practice physician or private practice owner is going to see this billboard as they go to work every day for a year. What message do you put on that billboard?
Ooh. So many things come to my mind.
Take a moment. Yeah, it's a doozy.
Don't forget yourself.
Why do you put that one? Why would you put that one?
We all forget ourselves. You know, once you get into this hero's mentality, you want to do X, Y, and Z for your patients. We all forget ourselves. And once we do that, that's where burnout really happens. And it affects every part of a physician's life, you know, personal, professional, and everything like that. And you know, and as you're asking me this, I'm just thinking of driving on I-10 here in Houston. And I'm like, man, that would be really cool. It's like, don't forget yourself. Like, huh, yeah, okay. And the other thing is that I think that one phrase means so many things to so many different people, but always brings them back to the core of who they truly are, the altruistic person that they have inside.
100%. And I think, I mean, I'll send it to you, but there was a post I made on LinkedIn that generated a lot of passionate responses from physicians about an article that came out about physician burnout and mental health issues. And I think what you said strikes right to the heart of that. So, well, Dr. Ruan, I can't think of a better way to wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're definitely having you back. For the listeners out there, thank you for joining us for another episode of Journey of Private Practice. Check the show notes. Go check out Dr. Ruan's upcoming summit. You're going to love it, and we'll see you next time. Dr. Ruan, stay on for a second.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Journey to Private Practice. If you like the show, hey, help other medical practice owners like yourself discover it. Please leave us a 5-star review, say a few nice things, and if anything, send this episode to somebody else, because I don't know about you, but for me, anytime anything good has happened in my life, it's been as a result of other people helping me. So forward this on, pay it forward, and we'll see you next time.